Over the course of my career, I've worked on many programs, and I worked with distinguished panel members for well over 20 years. I've got the privilege of working on the V-61 Model 11 in the late 90s, the W-80 Moorhead, the W-76-1, the B-61-12, the B-61-13, the W-88 program, and the W-93. So I understand that I've had the privilege of working throughout this complex, and I don't just understand this complex. I've been immersed in it, as the panel members have. And specifically talking about the panel members, they were specifically selected for this panel and for this session because they are practitioners. They don't just have general knowledge about how to accomplish work across the complex. They've done it. They have experience doing it. And each person, each individual on this panel has delivered product to the stockpile. And that's an important statement to make, because as we think about accelerating, as we think about the importance of delivering, we should start with the people who have done it. And so that's why I'm so privileged to have each of these members participating today. I recently spent some time at SpaceX, and it was an eye-opening experience for me. It highlighted a cultural difference that I hadn't experienced growing up in the nuclear weapons enterprise for over 30 years. SpaceX has a philosophy that I think we can all learn from. And I don't mean, and my intention is not to try to import their culture into the national security enterprise, but there are elements that we can learn from. And some of those elements are in the fact that every person I've met, from the individual sweeping the production floor to the person on the launch pad responsible for making final launch decisions, all were perfectly aligned with their mission and mission delivery. And if you asked any one of them, you got a consistent response. The next item I learned about is that they focused on managing risk. And how they managed risk, some people might think is reckless because they've had several what others might call failures. They call these events learning opportunities. And they managed and planned for these events and treated it as a byproduct of accelerating their timeline. So this construct of transitioning from notepad into launchpad rapidly and shrinking that time frame, or as one might argue if we're in the digital era, from iPad to launchpad, there was this clear focus on managing risk and accelerating through the program elements through careful risk management. Now, one might reasonably say that when dealing with nuclear weapons, failure is not an option. I would argue that instead, risk must be treated as something to be deliberately managed and not reflexively avoided. For decades, the enterprise has accepted what I would claim is enormous operational risk or deterrence risk in delivering capabilities late in order to avoid acquisition risk or in order to avoid what some might consider localized failure. That trade may no longer serve deterrence well, as we're hearing both from our administration, but we've heard this morning and we're going to hear throughout the conference today. So as the demand curve changes and the expectation to accelerate grows, I would say that linear risk-averse, requirements-heavy, requirements-heavy environments that are slow to integrate is no longer an adequate pace. And decision velocity matters. Velocity is a vector. It's speed with strategic direction. Speed without strategic direction is wasted time. So it's both energy and direction that we're after in terms of acceleration. Today I've asked our distinguished panelists, both from NNSA and from the laboratories, our tri-lab partners, to move beyond status updates. We've heard some of that today, and to really focus on what we can do differently to deliver more effectively on an accelerated timeline. And again, instead of introducing each member individually, I'll introduce and discuss each member or the panel panelist members holistically. Again, I've had the privilege of working with every single panel member, and I've spent 30 years in the trenches with many of them. They're true patriots. They've dedicated their careers towards delivering, They continue to do that every day, and I'm anxious to hear from them. Please prepare some hard questions, because I know that they're well-prepped and ready to do so. I'd like to start by transitioning over to John Evans, and I want to single out John Evans for just a moment. I've had the privilege of working with John Evans. John Evans has been a customer of mine. I've worked for John in an M&O capacity for many years. There's one thing that I've never questioned about John, and that is his allegiance to doing the right thing. He's always been focused on delivering on mission. Sometimes I may not have agreed with his decisions, but I always knew what they were based on, and that was centered around mission delivery and the success of the overall deterrent. So with that, John, over to you to kick off the panelist discussion.
Okay, thank you, James, and I'll tell you what, thanks for the kind words, but it's folks like yourself at the labs and the production sites that make this job rewarding, because the true spirit of can do and, you know, accomplishing things, meeting challenges, I mean, that is what is pervasive throughout this enterprise, and it's embodied in folks like yourself who have dedicated so many years to this mission. So thank you for those words. And right back at you, I can say the exact same things and more about yourself and all of the panel members that I'm on the panel with, so thank you. Earlier today, I went and gave a very quick update of our 7 modernization programs and some other work that is going on. And I will preface my comments on this panel with the fact that that work is preparing us to do even more and do things faster, and we have to look at it that way. We have to look at the modernization programs and our current programs as opportunities to improve. And if we don't do that, then we're going to be caught flat-footed when the nation calls on us to produce things quickly to fill some needs or to meet strategic deterrence mission needs. So we are taking those opportunities to learn and to get this big ship moving in a little bit faster way and to get it moving in a little more agile way. So I have a couple of real quick examples, but I'll defer to the other folks on the panel for really specific examples of the sites. But let's see, it's always a balance between having a disciplined, measured approach to designing, qualifying, and producing nuclear weapons, and doing it safely and securely, and then the need to do things fast. And so I think we all understand that, and we all feel that. Going forward, we have before us, before the Nuclear Weapons Council, some efforts that are under consideration to do things, and it's going to be vastly different. So instead of doing life extension programs where we start with a weapon in the stockpile and we figure out how to life extend it and basically maintain that capability for a longer period of time, we're going to be asked to do things where we're adding capability to the stockpile that didn't exist, and we're adding capability to the deterrent that didn't exist. And it's going to be in unique ways, and it's going to be in smaller numbers perhaps, but it's going to be for a directed and specific mission need. And so we have to understand what it takes to design, develop, qualify, and produce new things in our complex in order to meet those challenges. So, we're moving from a life extension situation into producing new when we go from, the 80-4, the 76, the 61, 80-4 and now into the 87-1, which everything inside the aeroshell is going to be new. And then the 93, which everything inside the aeroshell is going to be newly manufactured, and the aeroshell is new as well. And so that is a fully new acquisition program, and we're learning things on that that we hadn't learned during the life extensions. So a couple of things, a couple of examples, and then I'll pass on to the other members of the panel. So on the B-6113, we all know that we truncated the production run on the 12. We had the production processes up and running and qualified, and through the great suggestion of our labs, specifically Los Alamos, and working with our partners at the Department of War, we leveraged those production processes and were able to really quickly switch over and start production of components for the 13. And Y-12 did a fantastic job for its part as well. And we made the conscious decision to take risk and start production before we completed the qualification activities. So there were flight tests that we did not do, vibration and fly around tests and a couple of drop tests that we did not do before we started production. And that was a conscious decision between the program offices and the sites that we understood the risk, it was low, and so we would start production and move on. So that is an example, a small example, but a good one of where we take risk, where it's reasonable and manageable to take, and we need to do more of that. A second example is this Sea Launch Cruise Missile, which is a very rapidly developing program. We're working with the Navy. We have been given an IOC by legislation of 2034. We've set an internal first production milestone of 2032. And we're actually trying to accelerate, and we believe we will be successful in accelerating that even further from 2032. We're doing things programmatically. Now, this is where it allows us on the federal program office to do things differently too. Programmatically, we are not doing a very detailed bottoms-up weapon design and cost report estimate. Those usually take a year or more. And it starts with components, and you build component schedules, you build, you understand the costs, and then you understand the qualification, and you put together an initial cost report and schedule based on that. Well, we have characterized what we need to do very well at this early stage in the SLCM program. And so we're not doing that bottoms up, we're doing it top down, and we're going to call it close enough, and we're going to put a range on that cost estimate and move forward. And we do that knowing that we do have a limited set of components that we will have to produce, and we are looking at those very closely. But in general, we understand, based on previous modernization programs, the types of qualification activities that we need to do, and so we're very quickly pricing those out and estimating them, and we're going to develop and produce that weapon design cost report in under 6 months, and it usually takes, like I said, over a year. And so those are the kind of things that we are doing right now, and we need to do more of, especially when we get into these systems that we don't currently have in the program of record, but that we're gonna be asked to do. So with those two examples, I'll stop, and I'll turn it back over to you, James, to move on through the panel.
Thank you, John. For the rest of the panel members, I'll start with Brad Boswell. We have 5 minutes each. Brad, over to you.
Thanks, James, appreciate it. And we'll try to make good use of everyone's time. So. You've already spoken to, and I know that the speakers earlier today spoke to that need to have a sense of urgency and execute at pace, and I just wanted to reiterate that point as well. The processes that we've had have served us very well to assure real delivery of the backbone of our deterrent, and we know that there's more that we have to do there. And as I look at that, I don't believe we really bring it into kind of keep doing things in a traditional way and then have some kind of fast approach as well. I do think we need to be looking at ways on how we accelerate the move across the entirety of the program. Doing so, I think, reduces the overall cost for our programs, making resources available to take on other critical national security in the deterrence realm. The other thing it does do here at Sandia and with partner sites is it reduces the load on our highly skilled workforce. And it provides an opportunity to spread our experienced staff to more programs rather than leave them tied to a specific effort for a long period of time. I'm also very encouraged by the capabilities we have moving along to becoming readily available. Now we have to have the courage to take advantage of some of those capabilities, whether that's in high performance computing or other areas. One area that I've been watching closely, and we'll talk about later in the week as well, is the digital transformation that's ongoing. It really does afford us an opportunity to collaborate in ways that we never could before. As a PRT lead, when I was working on the 76-1, I'd be working independently much of the time, maybe getting together once a month, maybe twice, and really close to delivery time, to really coordinate closely with my partners. The digital environment lets me do that early, it lets me do it regularly, it lets me do it real time as well. I was thinking about the advantage that would provide on a situation like we have today. Imagine if we were working in a PRT environment. That might have been our once a month opportunity to touch base and real progress would be lost. In a digital environment, we'd be sitting down, and I believe our engineers are sitting down with enterprise partners today, working in ways that we couldn't have otherwise. It's also very interesting that digital transformation needs from a system integration perspective. As an integrator, it's really got all of our standing, those equities that come in from all our different partners and really facilitating timely decisions that are best for the larger system. And that visibility of the digital thread really allows us the opportunity to understand the equities of our partners in a more comprehensive way so we can help build that momentum and get decisions to decision makers in a timely fashion. Advanced manufacturing, rapid prototyping, all these things allow us to gather knowledge early and avoid expensive late discoveries. A recent example that doesn't even feel that late as we've been realizing 87-1. We've had the opportunity to do some very, very early checks at the system level on some of our cables. Not finding errors, but getting in those early discoveries that we need well before we go into production. That would be much more time-consuming and expensive to realize. Kind of moving from capabilities, as leaders, I think it's critical that we're bold in making change as we go along as well. If we look at the current processes that have served us well, I think we can work to streamline those, but just streamlining the current process, I don't think will result in the substantive changes that we could possibly have. We take 5% reduction in requirements, we're not going to realize a 50% gain in time. Instead of kind of streamlining, I really do think we need approaches kind of adequately manufacturing those new processes just as well in order to be successful. I think we also have to avoid the tendency when we look to go fast, to look at partners as the solution to going faster. I think we've all been guilty of that a time or two. You know, when we need to go fast, it's easy, to point to a partner and go, if that production agency could just do their piece faster, we would get to that solution, and vice versa. And we really do need to look at ourselves as we look at those steps on how we move forward and we move forward at pace. One example I've seen there on how we partner and go faster actually comes from the leadership of at Pantex under Wendy Baca. She's really demonstrating some courage, bringing the whole of the enterprise together, looking at how we can look at authorization basis at Pantex in a different way, and really looking at how we might accelerate there. That requires, work from Pantex, from the design agencies, and NSA, in order to really be successful coming together and make real change. But having that willingness to make that bold step, bring the community together, and set some aggressive goals is important. And those aggressive targets, I do think, are really critical. I mentioned the streamlining to me doesn't get us to the gains that we need. General efforts really don't get us there either. We see that. They have a tendency to kind of divert into what I would call more academic exercises. When we really get out and challenge each other with a specific challenge, it's easier for us to lean in. The B6113 example that John alluded to there, I think is a great case. And as I look back at how that program was executed, the target production, first production date, actually moved 3 times. The first date, I think everyone was fairly comfortable with. The second date, I think we saw a little bit of squirming, but the teams, you know, continued to pivot and move and challenge.
Brad, 30 seconds, and then over to Derek, please.
Perfect. When we move to the third date, and James, if you are setting an aggressive target on me, I think you might have been approaching the third aggressive target as we move. Really, really make the teams uncomfortable. And as leaders, put us in a position to enable that by asking challenging questions and moving. And I think that's, you know, kind of a final thought there as we talk about taking risk. As leaders, we have to encourage our engineers that taking risk isn't sloppy engineering. If anything, we've got to do a little better than we ever had before. And then finally, a thought for me that I've been pushing on my teams is put me in a position that I have to say no. Come to me with bold ideas, let's talk through them. And when I'm starting to back you off, then maybe we've got that right level of aggressive. If we can move that through the whole culture, it puts us in a position to move faster and move faster together. So James, with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you very much. Derek, over to you.
All right, thanks, James. Well, I'm gonna riff off what Brad was just talking about. I think we have learned a lot over the last several modernization projects. The program and NSA have built significant, basically capability capacity has been growing, and we're still continuing to build on that. I think one of the things that we have really learned about is that how important schedule is, and that schedule really is the priority. And I think that has taken a while for us to learn. I think it's taken basically the urgency that is coming from the leadership within the company for deterrence to basically force the enterprise to look at things in a very, very different way. I think we have been challenged over the modernization projects for lots of different reasons for holding to our original delivery dates. But really what it comes down to is that delays that we encountered, that's the real enemy that we're having to deal with within the complex. And it's really crucial that when we're starting to set our requirements and the like, which is very, very important, that we have more stable requirements. But the challenge that we have seen, I think, is that the requirements, certainly from what has been used to put the original or the weapons that are currently in the stockpiling, has basically mushroomed such that we have an inordinately large number of requirements. When, in order to contain the, I'd say, the growth in time within the program and the challenges that the labs and the plants basically have to work their way through, you really have to define that as critical, essential set, the must-dos, and then it allows you to start forcing the projects to do the trade-offs that are really going to be required for them in order to meet those very, very aggressive dates. Basically, where the enterprise is that it's taken us kind of basically a decade plus for putting things into the stockpile. It's very different from what it was when the original systems went into the stockpile that we have currently have in the 1980s, which was sort of a 5 to 6 year time period. Working and having the projects focus on very hard delivery dates, and maybe they aren't able to meet all the original requirements, but those hard decisions I think have to be made. A lot of this driven by risk assumptions, and a lot of times what ends up happening is that we individually want to assume those risks when, quite frankly, the assumption of the risk really needs to be handled higher up the organizational structure, potentially up into the DoD, into Congress, and perhaps to the President on some of these things. The other area that I think is really challenging for the enterprise is that when we are, all of our tech map work that we end up doing, currently any technology development work, whether it be for component designs or manufacturing, is basically what I would call in line with a particular project, such that the slightest hiccups that you end up having within a program will basically knock the schedule off the rails. And I think that in order to do this and do it in a more coherent way, really going back to the way we had been doing it in the 70s and the 80s before the end of the Cold War, was that the technology is developed really well in advance of when it's actually going to be needed to a very high TRL and MRL level. And then the programs basically will select those technologies that are pretty much ready to go and to do the design, necessary design and test work. So you're doing it at a system level. So really doing that tech map very early on is important. The other area I think on this, and I sort of look at it as a bookending, is there's an awful lot of work that has to be done at Pantex as part of the assurance process for doing the preparatory work for the design side of tooling or of the response work or quality or security or whatever it is that addressing that from the very beginning of the project and then making it a highly integrated parallel type effort is essentially very important. The other part is the very early engagement of everybody who is involved, at least at some point within the project, obviously from the conceptual stage. And this is obviously pulling in the production agencies early on when we're doing the conceptual work in the design laboratories, but it's also the other organizations and entities within the program that are needed, whether it be for the quality, or the safety, and the security. I also think that much earlier involvement, obviously, really an embedding of personnel from the DoD, whether it be the Air Force or from the Navy, directly onto the project teams. This is a bit beyond what the POG is, what we would have from a POG standpoint, would be very helpful, because then they become members of that project team at the design laboratories with the direct agencies from the very beginning. And the other one I think is very key is really making sure that we align those incentives across the enterprise. Basically, what it comes down to is that, from my perspective, your problems are my problems, and my problems are your problems, because we're not going to get there if just one organization is doing great, but others are having challenges and struggling going forward. So I think that making sure that we have a very highly integrated team partnership across the enterprise is absolutely vital. I think we have learned a tremendous amount over the last several modernization projects, and the program as a whole, I think, has made vast strides, and we continue to build and really grow on that. So those are my overview comments and statements, James. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Over to you, John Hill.
Well, good morning, everyone. I wanted to just say that there are some things that we in NSA have to do, change, update, and upgrade. So I have four or five topics I wanted to touch on. I wanted to touch a little bit on the linear process and the program of record, risk, digital thread, integration with our DOW partners, and just talk a little bit about requirements. So a lot of this stuff has been touched on by other people, so I'm going to kind of go through this quickly. As everyone knows, we have a very linear process right now. We say, let's do this for the Air Force, then let's do this for the Navy, then let's do this with the Los Alamos, then let's do this with Livermore, and let's pull Sandia in for all parts at the same time. And when you look at things literally like this, it kind of makes planning simple, but it doesn't necessarily get the job done. So I think a lot of people out there realize that I'm kind of a new and different type of person here at Los Alamos. I spent most of my career up to now in the Department of Defense, or the Department of War as it's now known. And so I have provided a different look for how to get things done. And so I think one of the things that I've noticed is that with this linear process, we have locked ourselves into the program of record. But I think it's time for us to look at when things will actually be delivered and our DOD and our Department of War partners are actually going to be able to actually deploy something. Rather than just looking at the program record and what it says, it's time for us to look at when things are actually required to be delivered and maybe adjust at that level. And we should look at this or this current round of the RPD, which is currently ongoing. So that's my that's a little bit on that. Let's talk about risks. I have a kind of an interesting example of risk acceptance that, because one of the points I want to make is that our Department of War partners have taken kind of a different view on risk than we have from the NNSA and the labs and plants and sites here on the NNSA side. We have kind of taken that no risk is acceptable. We've gone to the risk avoidance arena. So let's take a look at something that I was actually involved in. The CPS program, which is not a nuclear program, but what I learned from the CPS program is a different way of viewing risk. I ran the failure review board for one of the early CPS flight tests that was not fully successful. And one of the things that I learned from that is that particularly at SFP and the Navy view on some of these things, that it was time to stop looking at complete and total risk avoidance, and they actually looked at accelerating the program very quickly and looking at the possibility of having failures during flight tests. And one of the things that actually happened was that after looking at the testing that was done, we looked at the failure review board, we looked at all the possible ways that the testing could have been done, and there was a lot of testing that wasn't done before flight test, that on a normal SLBM type flight test, we would have never, ever skipped. However, the director at SFP and the same guy on the Army side who's part of the CPS, looked at the possibility of moving quickly, and so they understood the risk that they were taking and they accepted them. And so when the CPS flight test wasn't completely successful, the understanding was there. And so there was no look at, who to blame or et cetera, it was all understood. So I think that one of the things that's happened is that NNSA is looking at how to, especially here at Los Alamos, we're looking at how to look at risk differently. And so that's one of the reasons I think that maybe I'm here now to bring in some of that look at how to look at risk a little differently. Along with that, so the integration with the Department of War is very important in this arena. And so what we've actually done here is that we brought in a former Undersecretary of Defense to look at helping us coordinate with DOD. Also, along with that, I have brought my DOW experience to Los Alamos and to the NNSA. So James, I'm going to stop right there. Except I want to say one more word about requirements. We have to look at our requirements early on and discover whether our requirements are set for risk avoidance. And we need to get away from those types of requirements. So at that, I'll pass it back to you for questions, James.
Very good. Thank you, John. We do have some time available for questions. I certainly have several, but to be a bit unselfish, I will first extend the opportunity to the audience to ask questions. So are there any questions from the audience? And if not, I'll certainly see back the time and ask several questions myself. Okay, when you're thinking about when I'm going to start. The question is to the three lab ADs or ALDs. Each of you are currently chief engineers or informally filled the chief engineer role. If you were asked to accelerate the W80-4 program, W87-1 program, or the W93, and reduce the timeline to FPU and, more importantly, to LPU, What would you recommend? How would you go about accelerating the timeline? Let's start with Derek, move over to John, and then Brad, if you'll wrap up and answer that question.
Well, let's see, so those are ongoing programs, which makes a different set of challenges. I think one of the things that is really key, I'm looking at some of the product lines that we're working on now, is there are a lot of things that we scrutinize in production, where the tolerances, the requirements are very, very tight. In many ways, these are almost like bespoke items, I guess is the way I would describe it, where if it's not close to perfect, then we have a tendency to really not want to use them in the stockpile. I think by expanding the criteria and loosening things up, I would say quite a bit, I think we'll be able to produce a lot more, a lot faster. And I would give the opportunities at the plants to basically try to do things in a very different way from the way that they are currently doing, and then build upon a lot of the experience that they have. The other thing is that there's an awful lot of stuff that is currently either being built off all the modernization projects and the like, which I think provides some opportunity for being able to leverage those parts and potentially use them in other weapon systems that are being designed or that can be modified, both from a cost and time standpoint in a very effective way. So I think that also provides opportunities there. And then from the sheer amount of testing that we have, I know what we have had to do over a couple of the projects is that it's really looking at, from a design laboratory standpoint, the development testing and more specifically the certification testing in order to say, hey, this design is good to go into the stockpile, has to be aggressively scrutinized and questioned, I would say, on a continual basis, such that we don't end up over-testing, and to several of the speakers' points, to basically really be willing to take the risks. And I think some of the examples that John Hill gave are spot on for what was done for conventional prompt strike.
Thank you. John Hill, if you're still online.
Wait if you can hear me, James.
We can hear you.
Okay, good. I've lost video, but it'll probably come back in the middle of what's going on here. I actually agree a lot with what Derek just said. In particular, I think that where we can really make a difference is in our testing that's related to certification and qualification. And so if we split those two things apart, the certification part is where the labs and in the state come in. Does the weapon work? And then the qualification part is that does the weapon work in the delivery system? So all of these, both of these types of testing, we have looked at as completely risk avoidance, because there's been this, I know I've felt it my entire career, that any kind of a significant failure in this arena could end either the program itself. And so we need to look at how to reduce the amount of testing that we have been requiring for certification and for qualification. So I think that's where we can really make a difference.
Thank you. Brad, over to you.
Sure. I'll just double down a little bit on what my partners already brought up. And again, to me, the key to accelerating all those programs is really to evaluate the current design capability. What can the design that we have today really do or not do? And really address that with acceptability with the part of the board. And John just talked about it in terms of certification and qualification. We have set a very, very high bar across the board, as we should, both in terms of performance, safety, and security. No question there. And part of taking risk to move faster is having that conversation with all of our partners about what is that real capability we can provide. Are we getting 99% of the capability that's desired, and there's a few corner cases that aren't there? Maybe so be it, and we move on to provide that broader capability. And potentially gather that knowledge as we go. The other piece of going fast there, and we don't have all the right panelists to necessarily talk about this in detail, but we have to be mindful about what we're doing on the manufacturability side of the house as well, and that the designs that we're putting forward at a rapid pace truly are manufacturable. And again, that's where partnership comes in. The digital thread, I think, will provide that opportunity. We don't have that all programs right now, so it really relies on those partners to really listen. We've invested in concurrency for a long time as an enterprise. And so we're not solely relying on these tools. It does require us to move faster and really listen critically to the feedback we're getting from our production partners as well. I'll go ahead and pause there, James.
Very good. Thank you, Brad. A question for you, John Evans. We heard in session one that clearly you participated in from Dave LaGraff, from Dave Hoagland, about rapid capability and deployment of rapid capabilities. Certainly, we got some insight during session one from the NA11 vantage point. I'd like to understand your vision for rapid capabilities, how it ties somewhat to what Derek mentioned earlier about TechMat developing technology in advance of need. Would you share your thoughts on how to invigorate rapid capabilities and deployment of those capabilities into the stockpile?
Yeah, sure. So the whole notion of rapid capability is to deliver something more quickly that's needed to the stockpile than we have in the past. And so the goal is to develop a prototype within 3 years and develop a war reserve weapon 2 years after that. Now, that's what Dave LaGraff had put out. Now, what that assumes is that from day one, or day zero, is that we have a service partner and that we start working on requirements and production processes that we need to ultimately make quality products, quality parts that would go into a war reserve weapon. And that's day zero. So what we need to work with our Department of War partners on is understanding, what is the need. There is a certain benefit if we don't have a service partner right up front to go through and understand, the types of concepts, the types of solutions that are feasible, but that wouldn't immediately get us into a war reserve application. And kind of that's where we are today, where we are working with the Department of War to define a service partner, but we have already started within NNSA. And so we have a couple of projects that we're working on. What we need to do is understand the delivery vehicle that would be needed. And once we know that, then NA12 will partner with NA, and we are partnering now, but we are doing it in a limited fashion because we don't have everything defined. And what we need to do is start, within NA12, working on production processes with the labs and the production sites, right as from the day that a delivery vehicle is defined. So certainly making a prototype or developing prototype solutions is important. And, that's a step. But in order to get something in the stockpile fast, we have to make sure that both us and the Department of War are lined up to define a vehicle and define a capability from the very start so that we can get it into the stockpile the soonest. And so what that does is it allows us to, accelerate TechMat. It allows us to, take some risks in components and in processes because we know what that end goal is. It's like the B-6113. We knew what that end goal was, and we knew how to where the residual risks were and how to manage those, and that's what we need to do for the rapid capabilities. And we're working with the Department of War to define that a little bit better, but that we're moving out within NNSA already and making some good progress on the two projects that we have underway.
Thank you, John. We're out of time. What I'd like to do is bookend the morning session based on what Brian DeAndrea opened up with. And Brian talked about the importance of accelerating and the importance of moving faster. I'd like to also bookend that conversation or that topical area by just stating that the time is now, time is of the essence. We're being asked to do things that we haven't been asked to do in over 50 years. And with, as I look in the audience, I think about the other members, the current panelists, distinguished panelists that are part of session three, I consider this cadre of people to be our leaders. And what I'd like to highlight is that the question before us is no longer whether we should move faster. It's how do we do so responsibly without compromising safety, security, or the credibility of the nuclear deterrent? And what authorities, what opportunities and incentives can we utilize to accelerate the process? That's within our collective control. That's within your control. And so this isn't just about what the panelists are going to be doing in order to meet these tall objectives that the American people are asking us to do. It is what are we collectively going to do to enable our mission to support national deterrence. So thank you. Appreciate your time. Thanks again to the panel members. Great session.
Grab a bite, and we'll be back here in about 30 minutes for our next conversation. Enjoy.